Due to publishing deadlines, this podcast was recorded 7 days before broadcast on Thursday, 3rd of March. Due to the rapidly changing nature of news surrounding the invasion of Ukraine, some specifics, such as the termination of the Haas-Mazepin contract, hadn't happened at time of recording, but we chose to leave those parts in the podcast so that you can hear the discussion we had in full.
Bounce that back end. It's time for another flat chat. A new season of Formula One racing is at hand, and the season preview edition of GP Racing magazine is on the shelves. We've seen the cars running in testing, and mighty good they look too, except when they're porpoising, like something out of the 1980s, or would that even be a pogo stick? Apparently, internally, F1 and the teams prefer to use the term bouncing to describe the behaviour seen by those cars on track rather than porpoising. Perhaps because somebody looked up porpoising in the Urban Dictionary by mistake. But moving swiftly on from that, in our season preview issue, which, as I may have mentioned, is on the shelves now, we of course go under the skin of the huge technological changes occurring in F1 this year. The fundamental aim is to improve the spectacle by making the car's aerodynamic wake less disruptive to the performance of the cars following. F1 has done that by reducing the contribution of the front and rear wings to overall production of downforce. Do you know, I sound like I know what I'm talking about. It's almost like I wrote the feature. As you'll read in the magazine, F1 has also been able to use computing power beyond that available to the teams to run its own simulations of what might happen when the new F1 cars follow one another. Within the limits teams have to run to, it would take 4 days to run a two-car simulation. Using AWS cloud computing, F1 can do it in 8 hours. Still, nobody saw the porpoising coming. Here to speak to me about matters linguistic and bouncing-tastic, from all the way on the other side of the world, it's Mark Gallagher.
Yeah, great to be joining you. I'm looking forward to the season. I think it's a great issue of the magazine, and you've kept me busy contributing to it.
Looking forward, no doubt, to a hot lunch, not in the Urban Dictionary definition of the word, after this podcast. It's Ben Anderson.
Well, actually, I had my hot lunch before the podcast. I managed to squeeze it in between recording sessions, so it was a very quick hot lunch.
Lucky you, because if we don't, you're going to hear my stomach grumbling.
I was very lucky.
You were very fortunate because you've been recording a Autosport season preview podcast. I was part of a group interview with the new Aston Martin team principal Mike Crack, speaking down the crack pipe, you might say, and so it's all been quite a busy morning. As usual, we're already into the territory of stuff our producer has to edit out. Shall we return to the matter of hand, which is, the new cars? Obviously, as this podcast is released, engines are about to start running in the second test in Bahrain. Some teams will be bringing some upgrades. Other teams, noticeably Ferrari, say that they're not going to be changing their cars at all until the Bahrain Grand Prix. Do we think that Formula One has been taken a little bit by surprise by the weird rear end bouncing we've seen? Some of the teams reported that it actually damaged the cars during their shakedown. Alpha broke a floor when they were doing their filming in, I think, at Fiorano or Firenze, and Aston Martin also had some problems when they shook their car down at Silverstone. Lance Stroll said he couldn't drive, and there are probably a few people out there who said, well, we knew that anyway, but anyhow, this is time for me to stop, because the Lance Stroll fan club will get annoyed. What do we think? Has F1 engineered itself into a corner by making all these changes at once? Because it used to be that you could cure porpoising of that variety in the previous ground effect era by just making the suspension stiffer. Now, you can do that in a very crude way again now, but Formula One has also removed some of the hydropneumatic suspension systems we saw previously. They've gone entirely to, the conventional steel springing and hydraulic damping. So it's prevented them from backing out of it. So where do we go from here? And don't say, is it down to the lake I fear?
Well, they will certainly have been some unintended consequences of changing the rules in such a drastic way. It's a lot for the teams to work on all at once. But you'd have to think that to some extent they would have expected this kind of thing to happen, because I mean, this is a crude understanding, but effectively you have a stall in the airflow at a certain ride height, normally caused by a bump or what have you, and then you lose your downforce suddenly, and that causes the car to drop completely like a stone, and then the airflow reattaches and you get downforce back and it rights itself, something like that. Anyway, I mean, this is a thing they would have known would happen, because it's happened in F1 before, and you've got enough people with experience going back to that time. Also, I'm told, and Karun Chandhok was very good on this subject, it's happened in sports cars pretty much throughout. So it's not like it's an outdated phenomenon that's just been lost to the distance of time. It's something that people know about. Maybe they didn't expect it to be quite so severe. And I think you've got a variation through the grid, haven't you? You've got some teams like McLaren who had barely any trouble, if any at all. And then you've got teams like you mentioned, Alfa Romeo had a pretty bad situation with it to begin with, and they've had to work to try and get back from that. It does seem to be the case that if you had the old, more complicated suspension, it would be easier to fix. But at the same time, it seems to be a pretty simple trade-off based on ride height. So people are just going to have to run their cars a bit higher, a bit stiffer, like you say, work out the impact of the new tyres, because that's obviously thrown a curveball in. That's probably the main one, isn't it? You know, they've had limited running on the new 18-inch wheels and tyres, and you've got a different sidewall, much stiffer tyre construction. So a lot of the old Formula One suspension was done through that tyre, wasn't it? Took a lot of the load, and they don't have that now. So it's probably just a period of adjustment where the teams are trying to work out all the different competing elements and how they behave in the real world, which is always slightly different from your simulations and your wind tunnel time, because you can't, as good as those systems are, you can't quite absolutely recreate what happens for real on the circuit in Barcelona.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the beauty about having had this first test is that the teams now have all the data, which shows them the point at which you get that aerodynamic flow separation, which just loses all that downforce, and then really the porpoising commences and the bouncing starts. So they've got the information to show them the point at which that will happen. And I think, you know, Ben, to your point, it is going to be a question of the teams then working at their point of compromise. What do we need to do with our ride height? How to avoid this? Because, I mean, clearly we saw some pretty dramatic images of what it was doing. But again, as you say, some teams are not suffering from that problem. So I suspect, again, that 18-inch wheel introduction has been, you know, the 18-inch tires has definitely had a big impact. And we always knew, I think, that this first test was going to throw up what it was about the new technical regulations and characteristics of these cars that would now require all the work. So I suspect there's lots of midnight oil being burnt to basically refine how they're going to approach it and solve that problem, because it certainly is very significant. But it's part of the fascination, isn't it, about this new season, that there are some of the old certainties are perhaps pushed to one side. We've got some intriguing new variables which have been introduced under these regulations. And it was always going to be the case that some teams would get it right and some teams would get, not even get it wrong, but not quite get it as right. And I think that's the point where we're at the moment.
Yeah, we did a feature about McLaren in this issue, just looking at their resurgence, where they are in their sort of trajectory, hoping to get back to the front. And that car is quite unusual, and they've gone to a very unusual suspension layout, which is a pull rod actuated springs and dampers at the front and push rod at the rear, which is the opposite of how it's been done in the past. And interestingly, just as we started winding down and going to press, the Red Bull then hit the tracks. They've done the same thing. So it's interesting that in our feature, James Key says, you know, we've either got it very right or. And so he must have breathed a very deep sigh of relief when he saw the Red Bull has done the same thing. Notwithstanding, the McLaren was one of the least affected cars on track at the beginning of the Barcelona test, by the bouncing, the porpoising, whatever you want to call it. But they said they actually don't know why they haven't experienced that. They haven't done anything clever. They didn't see it coming. They didn't do something clever to avoid it. It just didn't happen until they started putting on their performance upgrades, which they had in the pipe, and then it started doing it. So, you have a situation where if you only looked at the headlines, McLaren are in a very good place, but actually this just contributes to a picture where it is so early in this cycle that we really haven't seen anything like the performance these cars are capable of. So it's going to be pretty interesting, isn't it, as we sit down to watch the Bahrain test and then the Grand Prix.
But this is the thing, to your point earlier, about what different teams are doing and whether they're going to bring upgrades to the test or wait till the race. This all depends on where you are in your own cycle, doesn't it? It's very conceivable that McLaren hit the track with a kind of safe setup, proper shakedown, make sure everything works. And then, as you say, as soon as they started trying to chase a little bit of lap time, they encountered problems that other teams hit much earlier because they went a bit more aggressive on the shakedown, maybe because they ran a filming day beforehand and did some of the earlier checks that other teams couldn't do until they got to Barcelona. And then once you start hitting the trouble, you've got your, on the one hand, you've got your already planned cycle of performance upgrades that you want to bring through the season. And you imagine there'll be lots of those penned in quite up front because people are going to be wanting to take advantage of the fact that the rules are new and they can add performance quickly. But equally, you don't want to get yourself lost. So when someone like Mattia Binotto is saying, we're going to take it calm for the two tests, we just want to spend time understanding the car, just refining the setup and how everything works, that's probably the more pragmatic approach, because until the cars ran properly, you won't know everything. You'll have great simulations and ideas about what might happen, but you inevitably run into unforeseen things or a degree of difficulty that you didn't anticipate. And you have to make sure you understand these problems, where they're coming from, before you go chasing other things on the car that might make it worse. And then you get yourself down a rabbit hole you can't get out of. So I can see the sense in both sides, depending on how confident you were when you hit the track for the first time and how aggressive you were being on your setup.
What this is ultimately going to lead to is an interesting scenario in the first, let's call it, half dozen races, where there'll be the potential for maybe some unexpected faces to be appearing towards the top end of the result sheet, because they'll have a good basic stable platform and setup, and that may not have the ultimate speed, but if you have consistency and the reliability, which is going to be so important, you'll be able to knock in those points. And it could be one of those seasons where you start off with maybe one or two surprising faces getting some really good results earlier on, while some of the more fancy teams are finding that as they look for that performance, they're coming up against a few obstacles, which are going to take some time to sort out. And so you could really have an interesting point by the time you get to, you know, around Monaco or Canada into June, where you have a team or two who have actually gained an advantage earlier on in the season, and then others are playing catch up. And so it's good. Again, this is one of the reasons why, in such a very long season, 23 Grand Prix, all being well, it actually gives a much longer opportunity for teams to overcome issues and to come back strongly. So, again, one of the final things I'll mention on this is that, of course, all of what we're talking about in terms of solving problems, developing cars, getting on top of any issues that materialize, are all having to be done within this budget cap. And that, of course, is adding another stress point to the whole picture, because gone are the days where a Red Bull, a Ferrari or a Mercedes could just throw cash at it and do whatever additional work they needed to in terms of resource. There is a ceiling on that. And I know from talking to a couple of people on the Cost Cap Commission, everyone, they're watching it like a hawk, because they know that this is a year where there'll be quite a lot of pressure on teams to really get the new formula right. And that's going to be another interesting factor to watch. So I think whilst we'll always continue to talk about the sporting regulations and the technical regulations, those financial regulations, that third suite of regulations, are there in the wing. And there has to be an eye kept firmly on those as well.
And you've got the Sorry, and you've got the sliding scale of aerodynamic development, wind tunnel time as well.
Yeah,
there's a handicap system, isn't there? So that's going to play much more of a role this year when people are throwing everything they can at their cars, unlike last year's, you know, partly frozen models. And then also you've got the situation where, because it's so new, and you've already mentioned Cotter's, you know, McLaren and Red Bull going a certain way on suspension layout, other teams going another way, things like that are not things you can change quickly. Some items are kind of locked in for pretty much the whole year because you've built your car around those systems. So if some teams will not be able to fix that until 2023. So if you've got it really wrong, then you're in for a 23 races of long pain, I think.
Yeah, what was most interesting for me was that having produced a car with this quite out there front suspension arrangement, James Key said that one of the important things when kind of compiling this car and its design philosophy was to have a very clearly defined path of upgrades you can add to it, given the resources you have to perform the upgrades. So they've kind of gone for a kind of a slightly open-ended philosophy that will enable them so they can sort of see where they're going with it, and they're not just going to be throwing random things at it because they just don't have the money to spend, as Mark said. You know, even if you had that money available now, which many of them don't, you physically can't spend it because the bean counters are watching.
And also, you know, eventually certain concepts will come to dominate, won't they? It's inevitable. So this is the time to enjoy the variation and the difference up and down the grid and between the teams, because give it a year or two, a dominant philosophy will emerge and people will understand how that philosophy works and everyone will start to push more in the same direction.
Yeah, it's a shame. Convergence is a thing, but it's kind of unfortunate. But that's the way Formula One's always been, hasn't it? Something works better than other things and everyone gravitates towards it. We saw it with the high rate cars that Red Bull, and to a lesser extent, Adrian Newey, when he was at Williams and McLaren, set the tone for the high rake. He just went very extreme in the Red Bull era, and people have gradually followed it. And it's only really Mercedes and a certain cloned car that have gone trod a different path in the past decade. But
and this is the
it
idea,
just goes to show.
This is the idea behind the, you know, having more standard parts, isn't it? This is another part of the regulation. It's a bit less interesting. But this idea of trying to have open source designs, because as James Allison was quoted in your excellent feature, Cotters, you know, everyone eventually works out the best design and everybody adopts the best design for certain things. So it becomes pointless to all be channeling resource into the development resource into something that everyone's doing the same thing with. So I think F1's trying to encourage certain parts of Formula One to just become non-secret, because what's the point of 10 teams all developing the same thing in the same way when you can just have, you know, collaboration to make it cheaper, whether that works or not, as it's because it's quite a change in your approach to Formula One, and it's not consistent across the car. So that's probably a work in progress, but maybe as this set of regulations evolve, we'll see more things that used to be the sole preserve of each individual design department become something more open and transparent and legitimately copied from one car to the next.
Yeah, listeners, I promise it is a very short section in the magazine, because not only is the whole scenario of listed parts not entirely fascinating, you know, it's interesting, it's intriguing, but you know, it's not something that Drive to Survive will be devoting an entire episode to. It's also incredibly hard to illustrate. So as I sort of was getting to, you know, the several hundred words mark, I literally, the blood was draining from my face as I visualized how annoyed our art editor was going to get at me writing all these words about something he couldn't possibly illustrate. And he would, you know, I was starting to pray that his Triggers Broom Tribe TR7 was in its usual state of disrepair, so he wasn't going to jump in it, drive down to Farnham and beat me up for writing pages and pages that could only be filled with text. Fortunately, we squeezed it down to about a page, I think. Now, shall we circle back to something you mentioned a few moments ago, Mark, which is the subject of hoping for 23 Grand Prix this year. Obviously, it's when you do a monthly magazine, things happen between you sending it to press and it appearing on the shelves. So as we closed off the season preview issue of GP Racing, the cancellation of the 2022 Russian Grand Prix had been rubber stamped by the FIA. And then, you know, while the presses were whizzing and spitting it out and putting it into envelopes to go into the post, F1 went even further, which I think none of us really saw coming, and terminated the entire contract. So the planned move to a new facility near St. Petersburg from next year onwards will now not happen. There will be no more Russian Grand Prix. And that's quite a big thing, given how significant and how lucrative that contract was. When the FIA had its extraordinary meeting of the World Motorsport Council, they actually pulled back from banning Russian drivers from competing. But Motorsport UK very quickly came out of the blocks to say it would not allow Russian drivers or teams to compete on UK soil. And as we speak, other regionals have followed suit. So how significant do we think it is that Motorsport UK was among the first to do this, given that it's headed by David Richards, who was in effect the kingmaker for Mohammed Ben Sulayem's FIA presidential bid and presumably is a significant influencer behind the scenes at the FIA nowadays?
I suspect it's actually a very elegant solution, because on the one hand, Ben Sulayem at the FIA has gone most of the way that he needed to in terms of dealing with the Russian issue. But then David Richards has helped him by closing out the one remaining sort of loophole, as it were, in terms of driver competitors. And I suspect David Richards and Motorsport UK will not be the only national, you know, federation to do this. So I think there will be others who will join in that. And that means that no Russian competitor will be able to take part in Formula One. I think, you know, it's interesting to reflect on these early months of Ben Sulayem's presidency. He's come in the face of the Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton scandal over the final race of last season, the way the championship was settled. He's been in the eye of the storm in all of that, and now is confronted with a factor completely out of Formula One's control, namely the start of a war in Europe with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and having to call that emergency meeting of the World Motorsport Council. And it's easy for people to criticize. I suspect there's lots of kind of fine balancing going on. And, you know, you talked, Cotters, about the fact that Formula One, first of all, announced that under the current circumstances, we wouldn't be racing in Russia this year. And then a few days later, the contract is terminated. Behind the scenes, the lawyers will have been looking at the fine print. And one of the things that, again, if we go back to our favorite channel of knowledge and deep insight, social media, people were complaining bitterly about the fact, why doesn't Formula One just cancel the Russian Grand Prix? But of course, you can't just cancel a contract. People will say, well, yes, you can. Well, you can, but you can find yourself subject to, you know, a massive court case. If not now, then further down the road. So what you have to do is really say, well, what can we do? Well, obviously, if there's a war on, you can look at the clause covering war and force majeure, you know, literally the physical, you can't actually go and compete. And that's very much what Formula One did on day one. They said, we're not going to be able to race because there's a war on. A few days later, you can be sure there's been emails and phone calls flying between the Russian Automotive Federation and Formula One, and the result is, you know what, guys, we're going to tear up the contract. It's terminated. It's over. It's game over. And I'm quite sure the Russian Automotive Federation and the promoters there will have said, well, if you walk away from us now, you're never coming back, to which Formula One can only have one answer, which is fine. We won't be coming back.
Bye, then.
You know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. So it's actually all moved terribly quickly. You know, we're at the time of us recording this, you know, in a matter of days, we've seen all of this take place. And of course, we now have to wait to see what happens next, because, you know, let's not go into the what's, ifs, and maybes around the conflict in Ukraine. But everyone listening to this podcast will recognize that if there is further escalation, which involves the borders of neighboring countries, particularly NATO countries, the Russian Grand Prix might not become the only victim. And I'm sure that the parents would be at liberty, and I'm sure the offices of Stefano Domenicali at Formula One, they're watching absolutely very closely to see what happens, because having survived, not just survived, but actually thrived through a two-year global pandemic, Formula One's coming out of that in the strongest shape we've seen for some time. And it's going to be just another major headache for F1 if this war in Europe was to expand and lead to the championship being called into question once again for another year for this other dramatic reason. So yeah, there's a lot of on the risk register of F1. I have to say the a global pandemic and then war in Europe probably wasn't on anyone's risk register 4 years ago, but they're both now taking center stage.
Bringing it back to the point you raised, Connors, about the FIA's action and statement versus the ASN's, I think on the one hand it would have been perhaps beneficial for there to be a completely unified response. You know, you're seeing at the top level, you know, governments, businesses, major divestment from Russia to send not only a message but to put pressure on the Putin regime to try and end the conflict as quickly as possible. And showing that unity is vital, I think, and sport has a role to play by, you know, following suit, if you like. And we know that sport is a very patriotic undertaking. So, it, you know, it's small fry compared to the bigger picture, but nevertheless, it adds to the tapestry of things you can throw at the situation. But by that same token, it's almost moot what the ASNs and even the FIA does, because this is all happening at a global government level. If the British government says, well, Russians can't come to this country, Russian businesses can't come to this country, you know, we're effectively at economic war with Russia, then the Motorsport UK has no choice but to follow that. It can't go against the UK government. So I kind of always had this feeling that, you know, in Formula One terms, the Russian Grand Prix is one thing, and I think the right decision has been made absolutely as quickly as it possibly could have been done. Like you say, Mark, the lawyers have to go through the fine print, and there are always riskier options and less risky options, and you try and pick the best one that causes you the least pain. But outside of that, in Formula One terms, it's about Haas, Uralkali, the sponsor, and Mazepin. And it already looks like Haas is in the process of tearing up the sponsor contract, because in this situation, given what the US is doing economically vis-a-vis Russia, it's untenable for Haas to have that sponsor on the car. He's a known associate of Putin, and that company is known to be, you know, affiliated with the Russian government. So I don't see how that deal lasts, for one thing. That already makes Nikita Mazepin's position in the team pretty much untenable, because where's the funding coming from? But then equally, even if ASNs didn't take the action they have, or the FIA said we're banning Russian drivers, how is Mazepin going to race if pretty much every country on the calendar is closing its doors to Russia? He's not going to be able to get a visa to go there and do his job. So he's effectively persona non grata anyway. So I think it's, given what's going on in the bigger picture, it's kind of, it's inevitable one way or the other. And we won't look back on it thinking, oh, the FIA maybe should have been stronger. Effectively here, you could just say it's a devolved issue. You know, we take our overall stance and the ASNs can make their own choices. And ultimately, all roads almost lead to Rome in that sense.
Do you know, I just had a flashback of standing in the queue at passport control at Seoul Airport, and somewhere up ahead, having been in first class, Romain Grosjean, paperwork not in order, and having a massive strop at potentially not being allowed into the country. But this is by the by. There is a phrase that has been used a few times in the past week, notably by Daniel Kvyat, and it's a phrase we've heard a lot over the past couple of years, when Black Lives Matter began and people in various sports began taking the knee before kickoff or whatever. And that phrase is sport and politics should not mix. This is something Daniel Kvyat said, you know, sport and politics shouldn't mix. Well, now, where do we go from that? Because, I mean, sport and politics shouldn't mix, but unfortunately it does, because on the Grand Prix scene, you have all these races that are national prestige projects, the Russian Grand Prix, personally backed by Vladimir Putin. He even turned up quite often ahead of the presentation ceremony. So,
or was it his body double?
Who knows? It could have been one of the many doubles. But so I would say that sport and politics have already been mixing for a very long time.
Yeah, it's naive to say anything different, I think. You know, the team principals like to say this whenever there's a press conference and a question is asked about some sticky issue to do with human rights or some country that Formula One's about to visit. And they always say politics don't mix with Formula One, but it's not true, is it? The whole thing is deeply political. Not only because of the geography, but also the global business interests involved. I mean, that's really at the heart of it, I think. And also, it doesn't ring true when you see, you know, the likes of Prime Minister Boris Johnson doing photo ops at the Red Bull factory in Milton Keynes. I mean, that's an explicit mixing of politics and Formula One. So I think it would be nice to live in that ideal world. And I do feel sorry for individuals. I mean, you have to feel sorry, obviously, for the Russian people who don't support Putin to be mixed up in this kind of thing, and also people like Kvyat who maybe don't support what's going on and would just like to go about their business and keep their racing careers going. But this is an unfortunate phrase to use. There's always going to be collateral damage in situations like this. You know, it's a problem that's much bigger than sport or Formula One or anything like that, but these things are inevitably going to be wrapped up in that mix. And you have to take the strongest action you can, I think, for the best possible outcome, which in this case is protection of Ukraine as far as possible, really. And if that means Russian athletes can't compete outside of Russia and no Russian events can happen and no Russian banks can do business and no Russian businesses or businessmen can access their assets abroad, then so be it. It just has to happen.
Yeah, I mean, you make a number of really important points, Ben, and, you know, going back to your earlier comment, in the case of Motorsport UK, David Richards spoke to the UK government, and as you say, the UK government have made their position very clear in terms of effectively economic warfare on Russia. So Motorsport UK have done the only thing which, frankly, would have passed muster and issued a statement they did. So that's been very clear and unequivocal. On the commercial side, you have massive companies like BP, sponsor of the Alpine team, Shell, of course, the sponsor of Ferrari, both completely pulling out of their Russian business operations. And to give you an idea, those two companies are going to be writing off something like $7 billion of investment.
Was it a fifth of all BP's profits, I think? Came from their Russian investment, didn't it, last year? So it's a huge thing. It's billions of pounds.
Billions of pounds. And their chief executive, Bernard Looney, I listened to an interview with him earlier on today, and he just said, look, this is what we have to do. Now, it so happens that BP are also on a strategy between now and 2050 of moving away from fossil fuels and becoming a much greener energy company. And I think the big picture on this is so big of what is happening. BP just literally pulling the plug on their entire Russian adventure that they've been on. And it's been a bumpy ride for BP over many years, that Russian engagement. And for Shell, for the senior executives at Shell and BP, for the shareholders, the decision has been rapid and it's been profound. And it's a massive decision, a huge financial cost to them. So when it comes to something as, let's be clear, as frivolous as motor racing, people involved in motor racing have to then just say, look, we're way down the list here. We have to follow suit on this. And your point is well made that it's tragic for all of the individuals affected by this conflict, sports people, civilians, anyone in Russia or Ukraine. Frankly, they're in the eye of this storm that's been caused by the Putin regime's behavior. So they're all victims of it. And it's not that, you know, Nikita Mazepin needs to be punished because of his dad. But, I mean, let's look at it from, you know, the Haas perspective. Haas have had all their eggs in one basket. There's only been one big sponsor on that car, which is this Russian, you know, oligarch and his son in Formula One. You don't need to read too much about Mazepin Sr. to understand that he's been in the inner circle with Putin for some time. And, of course, the other thing is that Ural Kali's, you know, of course, they will deal in multiple currencies. But let's remember that as a result of what's happened in the conflict so far, the ruble has devalued by, you know, 40 to 50% in just a few days. So if you have to pay your sponsorship fees in dollars, all of a sudden that's become a lot more expensive. So there's a whole economic mix in all of this as well. And, you know, I don't want to give Haas a hard time, but when you take a step back from this, it has looked highly risky strategy for some time that the only American team in Formula One had this massive relationship with a Russian company, which had a close relationship with Putin and dealings with Putin. Because let's be clear, you know, as has been described very eloquently on BBC by a couple of real experts on the Russian situation this week, you know, what you have in Russia is effectively like a kind of almost a medieval court where the king decides who's going to be wealthy, who his barons are, who his right-hand men are, and it is almost inevitably men. So if you are a multi-billionaire in Russia, you are a multi-billionaire because President Putin has allowed that to happen and there's an exchange of value. You're of use to him. So, you know, that's what you're dealing with. And it was always going to be a difficult strategy for Haas for all kinds of reasons. This has now really come to haunt them in the most brutal way possible. There's only one decision to be made: terminate that contract. That will mean that Mazepin's not racing for them. They need to go in a different direction. But frankly, Haas need to go in a different direction anyway, because at a time when some teams in the sport are actually fighting sponsors off, they've got so many sponsors coming in, there's something fundamentally wrong that Haas has to rely on, you know, that major Russian sponsor and that pay driver to make the budget work. So they need to find a new direction, and this is a pretty brutal way for them to do it. Of course, there's lots of discussion about can Haas survive this. You have to believe they will, because I think Liberty and Haas and all of the stakeholders of Formula One need to protect that team for all kinds of reasons. You have Mick Schumacher in there. I think they'll see it all out. To those of us who are watching, you know, Michael Andretti's hoped for entry into Formula One, it seems like a pretty natural thing that, you know, Andretti and Haas could do some deal, but we now know that that's just not possible. Gene Haas has not been interested in selling. Well, perhaps this will cause him to rethink that. And that might be another aspect of what happens as a result of this conflict and the fallout from it. But Formula One is a global sport, is political. And, you know, to all those points you made, Ben, you know, I couldn't agree more. And let's face it, when you look at the history of this, of motor racing back to pre-Second World War days, the Nazi regime funded, you know, part of the auto union and Mercedes-Benz program in the 1930s, because they saw Grand Prix motor racing as a way of promoting your nationhood and your statehood and your technology and your prowess. And that was a feature of motor racing in the 1930s. So politics and the sport have always been mixed, and it is kind of idealistic to say, well, you know, that shouldn't be the case. It's always going to be the case. There's too much money involved, and there is inevitably politics involved, because we are not racing in a national championship. And the moment we step over the borders of our country and start having an international series, there is necessarily a political, a geopolitical dimension to it.
Yeah, there was, I think, a point in the 1930s where the Mercedes cars on the grid were draped with Nazi flags rather than the German flag. And there's in the great book, The Life Monaco Grand Prix, which I reread recently, Ben's pulling a face, it describes one year boos as the cars pulled up and had the Nazi flags draped over them, and then when their local hero got himself a Mercedes drive, oh, cheers when the cars were unveiled. So it's funny, isn't it? You know, it's identity politics. Even so long ago, some things never change, do they?
Is this a book you wrote?
What surely you have a mental map of all my books.
No, on your partisan bookshelf, I can't make them all out.
Yeah, I don't think I've got the Life Monaco Grand Prix on this bookshelf. But downstairs, should you be desirous of a copy, I have a box. Mrs. Codling will be very pleased.
That's why I made the face, which obviously the listeners can't see. You neglected to mention I reread my own book, brackets.
As I was going through all these boxes that Mrs. Codling is complaining about, thinking what's in this? How can I move this on? Yes. I would say I'd need to go on eBay, but the last time I tried to sell some of my books on eBay, I got banned. So that's quite weird. Obviously, yeah, they think there's something weird going on there. Anyhow, shall we move away from politics? Let's talk about some more better news. Did I just use the words more better news? That is not the longest side of a right-angled triangle. In better news, sorry, there's a Pythagoras joke in there, isn't there?
Hypothetically.
Trust you to take a different angle on everything. Gosh.
Oh, very good.
Go ahead. Okay.
I'm angling for the end of this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, do you know, so is our producer, so are the listeners. Max Verstappen, something else that happened as the presses were rolling on this issue of GP Racing. Max Verstappen has extended his Red Bull contract until the end of 2028, which a word is that the deal is worth up to 50 million euros a season. And our good friend Ben Hunt of the Sun newspaper scribbled something on the back of an envelope estimating that Red Bull would need to sell 162,962,963 cans of its signature brew to pay for it. This figure, of course, not including inflation. Our contributor Luke Smith asked how many cans of Rich Energy would need to be sold to cover that. And well, there we go. Schrodinger's soft drink, Schrodinger's currency. Who knows? But yes, the significance of this. Max Verstappen tied into Red Bull theoretically until he will be an old man of 31. He'd be like your granddad, 31. So what is the thinking behind Red Bull looking to lock him in for so long? Who pulled the lever? Is it Red Bull wanting to keep him in the fold for that long? Is it Max saying, I want lots of money and consistency?
I think it's both, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't quite sign the deal he said he would sign. I think when he won the championship, he wanted to stay there for 15 years, didn't he? Let's do it for the next 10 to 15 years. So he's only signed for six. So already the negotiation hasn't gone quite.
He's had to row back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were like, we don't want you.
Sharpen your pencils, Max.
We don't want you pushing 40. So we'll review that later. Maybe Red Bull has an over 30s policy.
What's that film where everyone who, when they turn 30, gets executed? Logan's Run.
Well, I don't know if Red Bull are going to execute him, but that would be a bit drastic. I'm sure the lawyers can come up with a better way to extricate Red Bull from the contract if they need to.
Jenny Agutter will turn up, and in one scene that's never shown when the film's broadcast on a Sunday afternoon, randomly and for no plot point, takes her clothes off.
Well, this is going down a very strange, dark alley, I think. But back to Red Bull and Max Verstappen, I think it's very good news for Red Bull because they've locked down, you know, the driver they see as the best on the grid for the long term. And even if you know, not to get into this debate, but even if you think Lewis Hamilton is on par or better than Max, he's not going to be around for much longer. You know, he's 37 now. He's not going to be signing a six-year contract extension with anybody. So Red Bull are setting themselves up, aren't they, to basically, they're saying, we found the best driver in the world, we think, and we're committed to him now for as long as we possibly can be. I think when Karun on the Autosport podcast expressed some surprise that not only Max, but other drivers like Lando, Norris, are committing themselves for the long term to their current team so early when they've got existing deals that are yet to expire and they could give themselves a bit more time to get the lie of the land, you know, especially with a major rule change. Like, will Red Bull be as competitive? You know, are McLaren going to be right if they nailed the rules? You don't know yet, but in 6 months' time, you might have a better idea. So it seems it's probably better news for the teams because these drivers are good enough that they're going to get seats anyway, regardless almost of what happens. But for the teams, they get to avoid difficult conversations, people sniffing around their assets, and then the drivers get, you know, additional payday. Not that that's the major motivation, but I'm pretty sure that this is a significant pay rise for Max. So, you know, he can fund his own and his dad's retirement long into this decade with that kind of deal. I'm quite surprised in some ways that Red Bull have gone down this road. It's not really their usual modus operandi, is it? They kind of treat them mean.
Treat them mean, keep them keen.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, and Vettel used to talk about only ever doing 3 years, I think, contract extensions. That was kind of the max. Lewis has been doing usually twos, I think. Even while he's been committed to Mercedes for so long. So for Max to go for 6 years on top, well, 6 years total, isn't it? It was he had 2023 and it's another five. Yeah, that's a huge statement that team and driver are committed to each other. A huge expression of Max's loyalty. I mean, Jos used to always talk about loyalty to Red Bull, even when Red Bull weren't so competitive and there was lots of talk about whether he might jump ship to Mercedes. Toto was always an admirer of Max's. And Jos was adamant, no, Red Bull took the risk. They gave us what we wanted. They pushed Max into Formula One. We owe them the chance to see it through and try and achieve the ultimate goal. And they have done that. So along that journey, they've obviously decided that they're the perfect fit for each other. And why is there a reason to change? I mean, if Adrian Newey retires and Red Bull engine program post Honda goes completely belly up or in the wrong direction, he might have reason to change his mind. But then you'd imagine the lawyers have done a clever job and negotiated certain exit clauses so he's not totally locked in for the next 6 years. I'm sure he can extricate himself if he has to. But it's a clear statement that Red Bull are building around Max. There's no more, I don't think there can be any question that that's Max Verstappen's team now. So anyone who wants to drive in that team is going to have to be the supporting act.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, hearing your summary there, because if you look at Charles Leclerc at Ferrari with his long-term contract, you look at Lando Norris and what he's done, now Max Verstappen, there's a common thread, which is these teams are determining who is their number one driver and who they want to commit to in the long term, because they know that stability and consistency is so important. And when you have your prized asset, when you have the driver who you know can drive the wheels off whatever car you give them, you want to hold on to them. I think the other thing with Max Verstappen, and you've touched on it, is the fact that this contract will see us through, will see him through and Red Bull through to the next engine formula. And we're expecting an announcement from Volkswagen Group about their plans for Formula One. And, you know, if you were a betting man, you'd say that this might also be part of the reason why Max is committed for 6 years, because if what we hear is true, Volkswagen Group are going to come in and supply two teams with powertrain technology, one under the Audi brand, which may be Williams or another team, one under the Porsche
brand. Max wants the Porsche.
Max wants support.
He's angling for a company car, isn't he? He wants his 911. Yeah,
but you know, the thing is, if they are on the brink of those deals falling into place, and Max is a key part of that, that's another factor to come into it.
And you know, he'd have had sight of that as well, wouldn't he? As the team's world champion, they'd have said, "Look, we're going to do this deal with VW Audi. We're going to have Porsche engines in the next generation." So do you want to be part of that? I mean, it's a pretty exciting prospect, isn't it?
Well, it's a fascinating prospect. And, you know, to Ben Hunt's point about, you know, you did 162 million cans of Red Bull to be sold to afford Max Verstappen. I mean, last year, Red Bull sold, now wait for this, 9.8 billion cans of Red Bull were sold last year. I mean, drop in the ocean. And I mean, the Red Bull Group, the company had 7.8 billion euros in 2021 pour into their coffers. I mean, vast amount of money. Such a rich company. I always feel when I see a, if I see a round number like 50 million, you just know it's not right, because someone has someone has rounded it up, and very often they've doubled the figure and then rounded it up because it looks good in the media. And obviously there was this interview and a leak through the Dutch press, which is where this 50 million came from. And it's rather like the recent leak of the fact that the Oracle title sponsorship of Red Bull Racing was being bandied around as 500 million, which it isn't. It's not 500 million. And I think after some conversations, Red Bull were forced to kind of admit, well, actually, it's not 500 million. It might be much closer to like 300 million over a number of years. So there's a lot of rounding up going on. The reality is none of us know exactly how much Verstappen is being paid. It is going to be a large sum of money. It is a multi-year contract. He's going to be wealthy beyond his wildest dreams and never have to worry about rising gas prices in his household. so it's going to be, it's going to be happy days in the Verstappen household. But what we have now is a really intriguing prospect, which is that, you know, Lewis Hamilton this season and knows he's racing against these guys who have got contracts running far into the future, way beyond his contract with Mercedes-Benz. And, you know, Max, it's going to be really interesting to see what Mercedes does next, because, you know, Lewis has got his 2 years. Will he stay for another year after that? Will he even try to do another 2 years after this two-year contract is up? So, you know, Mercedes now suddenly look a little bit shorter term than some of their rivals in terms of the length of their driver contract. But there's no question it's very good for Max, very good for Red Bull, very good for Red Bull's partners. And we know that we're going to be talking about Verstappen in that car for at least the next half a decade and a bit.
Depends on George Russell, doesn't it, I suppose? What Mercedes does next. You know, yeah, Lewis absolutely. Has already talked about kind of helping with the transition there and building George up. I think Mercedes have already made their statement by promoting Russell. And I think the intention would be that he's effectively their long-term bet. He just hasn't got the contract yet. So what Lewis does will probably depend on how well and quickly George develops. And if he develops as they expect, Lewis probably can bow out after 2 years because Mercedes have got their guy ready to go and take the fight. But if George has some bumps in the road or it doesn't quite go the way they expect, they might need Lewis to hang around a little bit longer.
Yeah, and it's been interesting, hasn't it, that Valtteri Bottas, who, you know, you've got an interview with, he has been saying quite openly in recent weeks,
can't do it. You can't beat him. you can't beat him in the same
car. You can't beat him. I mean, he's just too good. And you know, I have to say, fair play to Valtteri. You know, he's not at the end of his F1 career. He's just starting a new contract with Alfa Romeo, but he's already doing what a lot of ex-drivers will admit after their retirement, which is that somebody was quicker than him. You know, and you've got, you know, Valtteri has had those years sitting beside Lewis and seeing just how damn difficult he is. And, you know, to Andrew Benson's sort of insight on just how strong Lewis is going to be this year and next, I think one of the implications of what happened in Abu Dhabi in December is that we have if it was ever possible, we've got a leaner, meaner, even more determined Lewis Hamilton in Formula One this year with all that experience. It's going to be something to watch, and that's going to be something else for Toto Wolff and the Mercedes-Benz team to manage, because that I don't think any quarter will be given either inside his garage with his teammate or indeed anyone else on the track. So it's the gloves are off and Lewis Hamilton's going to be gunning for that eighth world championship. No question about it.
Yeah. The phrase used was a righteous fire, and it's quoted by Andrew Benson in his analysis of Lewis in this month's issue, where a Mercedes insider said that the events of late last year, specifically the Brazilian Grand Prix, was responsible for the initial ignition.
Sao Paulo Grand Prix.
Yes, the Sao Paulo Grand Prix.
I must interject.
Yeah, yes, which, sorry, which, the, which, which of course was for political reasons, because Bolsonaro, president of Brazil, wouldn't allow it to be called the Brazilian.
A Putin border. Supporter, I think, isn't he?
A Putin supporter. Photographed with him in the Kremlin just a few weeks ago.
Yeah. He was allowed to sit closer, wasn't he? That's it. You know, the leaders he doesn't like have to sit at the opposite end of a huge table because of Vlad's well documented COVID paranoia. But if you're a chum, you can sit a little closer. So they had what was almost like a little coffee table, big enough for a couple of cappuccino cups or something between them. So that's the measure of how liked you are by Putin. We've gone way off.
Anyway, you're right. Yeah, the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, formerly known as the Brazilian Grand Prix, Lewis basically used that injustice and adversity as fuel to propel him onto this incredible run. I think the insider said it would carry him to the world title, and it very nearly did. Toto Wolff was quite explicit, wasn't he, about how Lewis, he mobilises superhero powers, I think was the phrase Toto used, when he's up against it. So having had basically, I suppose in his own mind, the whole of the FIA against him in Abu Dhabi, Lewis, it's be the point of Benson's story is, you know, what will this do to Lewis? It can only act as a motivator. And he's already said that. He's come out swinging, hasn't he? Saying that, you know, I'm intent on being the best version of myself I've ever been. If you think I was good in the final four races of last year, wait till you see what I bring this year. Yeah. And that is a formidable prospect. It's tantalising. If Mercedes can nail the car and Red Bull too, and we can just pick up where we left off in terms of the closeness of it, maybe with McLaren and Ferrari in the mix, maybe not right there, but as close as possible, then it could be a really, really exciting season. And then we can really forget all about Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, so long as the race director is not intervening too obviously.
Oh, we've got the virtual race director now.
Virtual race director,
and we've got two people where there was one, and we've got the old guy Herbie Blash to help out and basically be chairman.
So we're basically thrown the kitchen sink at race direction. Yeah. We've got a posse of people. We've got Formula One's answer to VAR. Divorce.
And that works so well in football.
Works brilliantly.
They're never still arguing about the decisions and penalties that should have been given. So of course that's going to solve the problem.
I prefer to think of it as like the television match official in rugby, where if properly used, the referee asks them to check something in the background and play continues until such time as the TMO has finished looking at their angles and decides whether there's something to be said. But obviously the two games are different, not just because of the shape of the ball, but also the general respect shown to Sir by the players.
Yeah, but also there's the fact that you can actually stop the match and everyone stands around while a decision is made, which we cannot Formula One.
No. On the sliding scale, I'd say rugby is the most stop-start of those games, which lends itself quite well to having extra refereeing. Football is somewhere in the middle. It's actually quite a flowing game, and having VAR interrupts that a lot. You get these various situations where somebody scores, the goal has to be checked to make sure it can't be ruled out. They celebrate, they stop, and then they sort of have to re-celebrate the goal when it's given, or maybe it's not given. And then there's no way of
spontaneously sliding upon across the ground again.
So you get an upset to the rhythm of the game. And of course, in Formula One, as Mark said, it's a constant race. There's no, unless there's a red flag or a safety car, there isn't really an intervention. So you're going to have to be very sharp with your reviews. Because, I mean, this is one of the reasons mistakes get made so frequently, isn't it? You know, everything's happening so fast in real time. You haven't got a lot of time to react, to make a decision. And if you have to review the rules, I mean, you have to have somebody who's really sharp on the rule book and knows how to interpret it exactly right, because you haven't got half an hour to go and have a look and sit down and talk it through and work out what the best course of action is.
Yeah. It can only be better than somebody who makes it up as he goes along.
Well, exactly. You don't want to go down that road, and hopefully this new system will be a bit more robust. And you basically have a sense check, won't you, by having three people where there was one, and not noisy team managers banned from chewing your ear off every second. You would imagine that the new guys, Nils Wittich and Eduardo Freitas plus Herbie Blash, can make more considered decisions that are agreeable to everybody, and we won't have a repeat of the acrimony that we had last year.
And all of this, to me, begs the question why the FIA didn't realize that when Charlie Whiting passed away, that they needed to completely change the way the race was run and operated. And there hadn't been a sufficient succession plan in place, so that when Charlie disappeared, and Michael Massey was thrown in the deep end and has then had two very difficult years and has now effectively lost his job as race director in Formula One. And FIA has now created a completely new structure. And you kind of think, well, actually, if Massey had had that structure, if he'd had the benefit of that support, things would have been different. And by the way, if he hadn't had people screaming at him, including team principals, things would have been different. And a number of decisions were made, not by Michael Massey, but by FIA and F1 to do with broadcasting those audio messages, which actually made his job almost intolerable. And ultimately, he has paid the price for that. And so while I don't agree with the comments of Dr. Helmut Marko that, you know, Massey's lost his job because of Lewis Hamilton, Massey's lost his job because of the decisions that were made on that day. But it was within the context of him as an employee of the FIA and the structure which they had created him. And there wasn't enough support being given to him. And let's hope that we have a clear run at this season. I suspect everyone is going to be watching for that first incident, that first off-track moment, that first time when a driver, you know, decides to open the wheel in a corner and push their rival to one side. That's, and if we do get that head-to-head battle continue between Max and Lewis, it could be quite fraught.
It depends, doesn't it? You know, whether the new race directors and the rotating cast thereof decide consistently to apply the let them race philosophy. Because I think the problem, I may be going out on a limb here, I think one of the problems we had was, while let them race is a perfectly good abiding philosophy, where do you then draw the line where something becomes a little bit unacceptable? And I think that there was some inconsistency in where that line was drawn over the past couple of years, which opened up this uncertainty and this sort of general lack of respect and people just trying to push to see what they could get away with.
I don't think they ever really drew the line. That's the problem. You know, like when... You're always going to have competitors and drivers pushing the limits of what's acceptable. That's part of the game. And that's part of what was happening with team managers speaking to Michael Massey. They were trying to manipulate the race to their own advantage. I mean, that's their job. So what you need is a robust system that counteracts that. So if you need more than one person because they can't do it, that seems to be the way the FIA and F1 are going now, then fine, you implement a shield. That basically means these people can't influence your decision making. It's not their right, and we won't allow it. Even if it did look good for the broadcast, we'll put a stop to that. That's fine. But regardless of that side of it, there will still be situations that appear on track that need some interpretation. It's always a question based on the circumstances, the track, who the competitors are, what the overriding circumstances are of the season. And things get thrown up that you can't foresee. And that's, I think, Brazil, Sao Paulo, Interlagos was the clearest example of that. Verstappen doing something that really most drivers would say, well, that's not on. You don't do that. So no one really does it. It's not expected. He's tried it and he's got away with it effectively. And that sets a precedent. So then you have chaos at the next race because suddenly everybody thinks that's acceptable. I should say two races later, because I think Saudi came after Qatar, didn't it? So people are left in a limbo where they've seen something that they think isn't acceptable, but there's been no ruling about it. So technically it is acceptable, or it has become acceptable, but people don't feel it is. So then they don't know how to behave. And then you get some people, Leclerc's been quite clear about this. He waits to see how things evolve, and then he adjusts accordingly, because, you know, he feels he got pushed out by Max in Austria, I think it was, a few years before, and there was no penalty. So then a couple of races, or even a race later at Silverstone, he drove the same way in defence, knowing that he wouldn't be punished. So this is where you need the strong leadership that I think was lacking. And I think in the Charlie Whiting days, as I said on a previous podcast, after Sao Paulo, he would have got everybody together, talked it through, got the general consensus of what was acceptable. Max is obviously not going to say what I did was wrong, but probably everybody else in there near enough, regardless of which team they drove for, would say you certainly have a majority view, I think, that that kind of wheel-to-wheel fighting isn't acceptable etiquette. Charlie would have made a ruling. He would have said, right, we're updating. This is what I expect. If I see this kind of driving, there'll be punishment. And it would have been clear. You know, you can evolve the rule book as you go. There's nothing wrong with that, so long as everybody knows where they stand. But I think Michael Massey's big mistake in this respect was leaving it open to interpretation of individual stewards, individual races, just saying basically play on and you'll get inconsistency based on who's looking at it. Every instance is different, so we can't rule in one way. Well, I don't think that quite holds water. You just create more problems. You can't have the Wild West when you've got a sport that's so highly regulated in other areas. And you can't
Schrodinger's driving etiquette.
And you can't just say, oh, because there's a gravel trap on the outside, that's a penalty. But because there isn't a gravel trap, that isn't a penalty. You know, basically, if someone forces a guy off the track, then they shouldn't be allowed to do that. There should be some kind of recompense for that. And I think you saw in Austria earlier in the season, was it Norris? Perez was penalised, I think, and so was Norris, both of them for doing that kind of move because there was gravel on the outside of the corner. And Max got away with what he did in Sao Paulo because there wasn't. And I don't think that's enough. You know, everyone would look at that kind of driving and say, you can't do that. And some would probably say that approach is less tolerable than a kind of trying to force the guy wide as you're overtaking him and it maybe goes a bit wrong and you slightly misjudge it. So yeah, I'd feel like a move like Lando did in Austria or Perez did in Austria, if that's a 5-second penalty, then what Max did is definitely a 5-second penalty or more. And I feel really you need a more robust system from the FIA to recreate some of what Whiting did, which is stamp out that kind of generally unacceptable but not quite against the rules etiquette that will always eventuate sometimes in the heat of battle as people try new tactics and try to see what they can get away with. It's no different to trying to bend your wing a little bit to, you know, get round a rule or get within a tolerance. You know, you need to keep constantly evolving your processes and your regulations and your stewarding and your scrutineering to stay on top of what these teams are doing, because they're pushing, evolving and always trying to find an edge wherever they can.
Did you just use the word eventuate?
I don't know.
You did. You used the word eventuate. Usually, Mark, Ben never uses the word eventuate without saying, adding on, as you would say, Codders.
I've obviously worked with you for too long and now I've absorbed.
You're being infected by the urban dictionary.
It's terrible. I'm going to have to go and have a lie down, have a quiet word with myself. Maybe
this abstruse and recherche lexicon. Well, it probably is about time for you to have a lie down because we've gone over the hour and it is time for us to wrap up.
Sorry, listeners. That was probably mostly me going off on one about the FIA and the driver's etiquette.
You're allowed to.
That's
this
okay.
is a
you're
podcast.
Yeah.
And of course, the listeners know your email address and can write into you or the magazine to complain or leave a stinking review should they so desire. There's plenty of other things to read in this month's GP Racing. Mark's written two features, one on the new Miami Grand Prix, which is something we're all looking forward to visiting. As previously mentioned, exclusive interviews with Valtteri Bottas, also Guan Yu Zhou and Alex Albon. The next edition will be out on Thursday, April the 7th, in the words of Sarah Kennedy, if we're spared. And thank you very much to my guests in South Australia, where surely it's beyond midnight right now, so don't feed those mogwai. Thank you, Mark Gallagher.
Thank you so much, it's been a great pleasure.
And in rural West Sussex, thank you, Ben Anderson. Indeed, thank you very much to Martin Lee for producing as ever, and thank you for listening. We'll be back in April.